From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mission District.
Fremont.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Temescal. Tenderloin.
Treasure Island. Richmond, California.
Coming up, we'll find out where some of the largest residents of Suisun Bay are disappearing to and what they'll be leaving in their wake.
It hurts to see her there just, you know, wasting away. It really hurts to think about having her scrapped.
Then we'll hear how famed photographer Ansel Adams chose to document the UC Berkeley campus.
He would go photograph them with great interest and with a keen eye. And then, of course, this technical proficiency and this just ability to make aesthetically beautiful photographs. He was just a gifted photographer.
The history, images, and people who inspire us. That's coming up on today's edition of Cross Currents. Fleet Week might seem like the Bay Area's most visible and audible nod to the military, but if you really look around, remnants of the Bay's long military history are all around us. In the barracks of the Presidio, on the shores of the Bayview Hunters Point shipyard, and in the water itself. If you drive north over the Benicia Bridge, off to your right, you'll see a fleet of giant ships in Suisun Bay. They first arrived in 1946 and continued coming in over the following decades. In theory, if the Navy ever needed extra ships, they'd get them from this reserve fleet.
In a general way, the solution is to keep the ships and work out a method of keeping them with the fewest men and least money. Of course, a few of them can be scrapped, but only the obsolete ones. A great many remain, good ships, worth hanging on to.
That's from a film made by the U.S. Navy in 1945. But it turns out the Navy has not needed them. And over time, the fleet's become a graveyard that needs a lot of upkeep. In 2007, an environmental group sued the government over the condition of the fleet, and in 2010, they won. Now, almost all of the mothballed boats are on their way out. And as they go, so will a hefty part of the Bay Area's naval history. KALW's Ashley Ann Krigbaum snapped on a life vest and went out to Suisun Bay to find out just how soon the ships will leave and what exactly they'll leave behind.
The Allied Expeditionary Naval Forces execute their mission to assure the safe and timely arrival of troops, weapons, supplies. A mission which will have a profound effect on the history of man.
The biggest job at Normandy wasn't just putting the soldiers there, it was resupplying them.
This is Captain Patrick Maloney, and his ship is the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. It's a United States Liberty ship that served the Merchant Marines during World War II, delivering supplies to Normandy during the D-Day invasion.
We talk about the teeth and the tail. The soldiers at the front are the teeth. Well, this ship carried the tail.
These days, though, it sticks a lot closer to home as a floating museum docked at San Francisco's Pier 45.
The O'Brien was the first merchant ship to be saved as a memorial. She steamed out of the mothball fleet under her own power, the only ship ever to do that.
The mothball fleet is a collection of old warships that have had a retirement much less active than the O'Brien. For the most part, they've been docked idly for decades in Suisun Bay near Benicia. Maloney spent over 12 years on them back when they were still sailing.
I've served on 24 ships, commanded 13, the ones up in the mothball fleet were the Toluga, the Mispillion, the Haciampa, the Kawishui, and the Ponchatoula.
Maloney remembers each of those ships individually, like old friends. He even knows exactly where they live now.
A number of ships up there. I had four of them in G row and one in F row. One of them, the Haciampa, which is the closest one to shore. If you pull into the overlook, she's the one you'll see. I spent 5.5 years on her, 4.5 in command. It hurts to see her there just, you know, wasting away. It really hurts to think about having her scrapped.
On a Monday morning, Joe Pecoraro and I board a small boat in Suisun Bay and head out to the mothball fleet.
Over here is G-Row.
Pecoraro is the fleet's superintendent. He's maintained the ship since 1991.
There's only 4 ships left on it, and the outboard ship here is next on the list to leave.
We head into the row, and there, right where Captain Maloney said it would be, is the USS Hassayampa, creaking away out on the water.
It gets a lot quieter up on deck on a day when there's not a lot of wind and not a lot of wave action. It's very still and quiet.
The ships are massive, most stretching over 500 feet in length. They weigh anywhere between 5,000 and 20,000 tons, and that's without cargo. From far away, they look noble and intimidating, and undeniably powerful. In reality, the majority of them aren't going anywhere unless they're tugged out.
Yeah, I used to dislike that word, mothball fleet, but it's akin to, you know, like you're going to put clothes away for a long time, and you put mothballs in it to keep the moths from, you know, from eating it up.
Long-term storage has its risks.
Lead, cadmium, zinc, chromium.
Michael Wall is a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC. In 2009, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration found all those metals Wall just listed in shellfish and other species near the ships. The likely culprit is the lead-based paint flaking off the ship's exteriors. The paint was actually
designed to kill aquatic species that adhere to the hull. And this paint was just sloughing off into San Francisco Bay in massive quantities.
At least 19 tons by 2007. The levels of toxicity around the ships weren't that much higher than other parts of the San Francisco Bay, but they were significant enough that the NRDC filed a lawsuit against the government and won. The Federal Maritime Administration has done a lot to clean up over the past 3 years. Over 300 tons of hazardous paint has been removed, and the ships in the worst shape are gone.
So the fleet is in much better condition than it was, and the Maritime Administration should be commended for cleaning it up and getting its house in order.
Keeping that house clean is a full-time job. Actually, quite a few. As Pecoraro and I head back toward shore, we pass the fleet's main offices, which are floating at the end of a long dock several hundred feet from the fleet. The dock buzzes with workers in union suits and hard hats, electricians, crane operators, riggers, mechanics.
Each ship has a flooding alarm. Once a month, those have to be tested.
Electricians come out monthly to inspect the fire alarms. Another crew checks the ship's moorings, anchors, and chains every day. And the whole time, someone has to make sure the insides of the ships stay dry so the mothball fleet doesn't mold.
That's pretty much an average day in a nutshell.
28 ships are left for that crew to maintain. 18 will be scrapped over the next couple of years, including 5 that will be gone by the end of this year.
Okay, practical lesson here. You're on a ship.
Back on the Jeremiah O'Brien, which is still in working order, Captain Maloney is giving me a lesson.
In case you lose your balance and pitch forward, the strong part of your hand is holding it instead of little fingers.
Most ships in the mothball fleet will take one last journey, a 6,500-mile trip from San Francisco through the Panama Canal, and finally to a scrapping facility in Texas. Not the O'Brien, though. Captain Maloney's ship will be making a different journey, an 11,000-mile round trip to Normandy to celebrate the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
You know, that's a warm-up cruise for 2044, going back for the 100th anniversary. And actually, I'm starting to make noise now about, D-Day plus 75, that's pretty good. But Pearl Harbor Day is coming up in 2016. Pearl Harbor plus 75. Let's go to Hawaii.
The O'Brien seems to be able to go anywhere. But for Maloney, it can't quite replace the ships that are gone forever and the big empty space they leave behind. For Cross Currents, I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum.
Marad says that these reserve fleets are still a strategic national asset and will need to be used going forward. Today's fleet is anchored at just 3 ports, Virginia, Texas, and Suisun Bay.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. One man responsible for recording much of Northern California's visual history is photographer Ansel Adams. He's best known for his iconic photos of Yosemite National Park and other areas of the West. But even this fabled photographer had to do commercial work to make ends meet. One such project took place in 1967, documenting the UC Berkeley campus at the request of Clark Kerr, former UC president. It's called Fiat Lux. Original prints from this commission are on view at Cal's Bancroft Library, ending this Friday. Sam Redman, a historian with the library, spoke with KALW's Stephen Short about the show and about Ansel Adams himself.
His journey is one of discovery so often, and he learns about different events that are taking place as they concerned politics and culture and society, but then also the environment. And he would go photograph them with great interest and with a keen eye. And then, of course, this technical proficiency and this just ability to make aesthetically beautiful photographs. He was just a gifted photographer. So he discovers ideas as he goes, and he discovers interesting topics to document. And that's what I really admire about him, sort of this journey of discovery. And what you can see in this exhibition, Fiat Lux, is his sort of taking that eye to the many activities of the University of California at this time, at the different campuses and in different contexts, from medical research to science taking place in field labs. It's a really remarkable array of activities by this point, and Ansel Adams works to document that.
That's a good point you made about him being both technically proficient and artistically proficient, because sometimes those two don't go together. I know in photography they say you have to have a good eye. You can't teach that. But he also made photography popular to the general person. I think partly because his stuff looks so good. Everybody wanted to try to look like that. But I think that it would be fun to play that clip right now with his impression of what amateur photographers were like in their photo clubs.
When I first started in photography, left 1930, it was people like Willard Van Dyke and Edward Weston, who then came on the scene, of course. They followed us. We found that here we had all the damn camera club people with hideous taste and imitative stuff, with soupy sentimental business, and a lot of them had a very fine technique, which was very irritating to me. They knew a lot about it, you know, but what they did was so terrible in aesthetically.
Terrible aesthetically?
Adams proclaims that he had a certain visual sense that other people maybe lacked, which is why he likes working with photography. But he also gives many insights in his oral history about being at the right place at the right time and knowing when to capture a certain moment, or being incredibly patient and waiting for a photograph for hours and hours on end until the light was just right. And he's also emerging out of a context of a time where people are talking about light and photographs in all sorts of interesting ways. Painters in California had long proclaimed that the light in California was a sort of unique light that gave them a special advantage in painting. And Adams is taking advantage of light in California in an era where color photographs are starting to come along, but he sticks with this format of black and white, in which he's very technically gifted in capturing light and shadows and faces and large landscapes especially.
He did say it was pretty intuitive, and everybody, well, anybody who's serious about photography knows that you do need to be in the right place at the right time, and there's the magic light moment and all of those things that he talked about. But let's hear it from the man himself talking about being intuitive.
But it's all intuitive. It has to come very quickly. That means you have to practice. If I don't go out with the camera for quite a while, I find myself very, very clumsy for a while. I just lost physical contact with the camera, and I haven't got quite... I have a little difficulty seeing and framing this vision. Like what I do with you sitting there with your pad and, pencil and pad, I could go click and get a really good record of it, which you would date on the back and be very valuable, and I think I have enough mechanics to get a good exposure. Well, that wouldn't be the picture. The picture is a combination of all the relationships, the back line in your dress, the back lines on the blanket, and the the element of life and something around here to get rid of it, something in the background that says destruction. If you can't get rid of it, you use it. But it's all like playing. It's thousands of things are going on at one time. And if you can't be aware of all those things, and you can't analyze them, because if you did that, you'd ruin it. It's just, you practice for years to get a facility in your fingers, tone control, shaping, dynamics. And when you play, you can't think of it. You just do it.
Sam, have you seen the Fiat Lux Redux? I guess that's how you say it. Have you seen the exhibit? Were you especially impressed with any of the images?
Sure. There are a number of images that are really great. And to me, what else is great is the stories behind them, including there's a great image of someone getting a heart valve transplant.
That doesn't sound like one of an Ansel Adams landscape.
It certainly isn't. It's not something that you would expect, maybe. But Adams talks about in his oral history waiting for several hours during this complex procedure before being ready to take the shot. And the doctor quietly calling him over and saying, "Okay, Mr. Adams, we're ready for you to take this photograph." And the first thing that happens is that the lens cap falls off and nearly falls into the body cavity. But it falls on the floor. "No harm is done, Mr. Adams," says the doctor. And he takes this beautiful photograph of the middle of this procedure, showing some of the activities that go on this campus that are really something that you might not see by just, you know, seeing the surface of the campus. So Adams brings an eye to both the great landscapes, but then also these minor, in terms of size, but really magical moments. And he manages to do it in a really human sort of manner, with some really thoughtful ideas that are behind them that make this exhibit really a rich thing to explore.
That's Sam Redman speaking with KALW's Stephen Short. The exhibit Fiat Lux Redux will be up at the Bancroft Library through Friday. For more information, go to our website. It's kalw.org. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. In San Francisco, there's a program that pairs aspiring young writers with professional mentors. It's called Writers' Corps, and it's sponsored by the San Francisco Arts Commission. The group is sharing some of their work this Thursday, March 7th, at the Contemporary Jewish Museum. And one of the students who will be reading is apprentice De'Asia Landrum.
I haven't been writing for very long, but there's just something in me that loves poetry, just loves the way it sounds, and love the message that people get through when they speak in like these crazy tones and using these like awesome metaphors. And that's why I write today. I told the apprentice program that I wanted to write because I didn't feel like there were a lot of writers like myself. And so I wanted to write myself into something better and into, you know, history in a way, write myself into a legacy.
We asked De'Asia to share an excerpt from one of her writings with us. This is from an untitled poem.
"It's safe to say that I will never see myself the way my father sees me. He tells me that I was made in his likeness and his image. But don't think it cliche when I tell you that daddy's little girl isn't happy. See, my father is something like a Renaissance man, and I, something like his avant-garde masterpiece. Deliberate in his intent, he fashioned me out of ebony to reflect just how brilliant the darkness shines in the light. However, pop art has made me disillusioned with his artistry, and I have tried to recreate myself into something a little more acceptable, a little more fashionable, a little more mainstream, a little more white. See, my father painted my skin the shade of night so people could see just how brilliant and beautiful the sun's embrace is when it blankets bone and becomes flesh. However, somewhere along the lines, I think my father forgot just how intimidating the night can be for people who fear not being able to see past themselves. So I've taken it upon myself to fix his mistake and recreate myself. Picking up where he left off, I started to lay a blank slate on top of my father's artwork and paint the moon in between the small cracks my melanin left open in its haste to fill the spaces, anglicizing my ancestor's chocolate skin with vanilla frosting.
That's Writers' Corps apprentice De'Asia Landrum reading an excerpt from her untitled poem. She and other Writers' Corps students will read their work along with author Tamin Ansari at a free and intergenerational event this Thursday night at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in downtown San Francisco. You can find details at our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can find all of our stories and subscribe to our podcast. Been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Nina Gensler-Debs, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Laura Saponara, Judy Silber, Raisu Sussman, Stephen Short, and Mary Wallace. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll hear how experimental pianist Sarah Cahill describes the music that inspires her.
I don't feel a sense of purpose or that I have so much to say about the Bach English Suite in A minor that no one else has to say. But with the composers I work with, I get to premiere their pieces, record them, commission them, introduce the world to these people.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The music you're hearing was composed by Daniel Capo of Oakland. Capo is a grad student at Mills College and is taking part in this year's Signal Flow Music and Sound Art Festival. Signal Flow is an annual spring festival of experimental work by students, and it's going on this week. Capo is one of 5 performers on Saturday at Littlefield Concert Hall at Mills. Music begins at 8 p.m. and admission is free. We'll put a link to all of that information at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.